Welcome back to the Furs and Frontiers podcast. I'm your host, Tracy Walmer. Today we're going to explore the largest battle that the mountain men experienced during the North American fur trade, the Battle of Pierre's Hole in 1832. This event has been told and retold so many times online that it's gradually morphed into something hardly resembling the facts. So today we're going to get the facts from the men who were there. If you're not familiar with the western United States, there's a shallow valley in eastern Idaho near what is today the town of Driggs at the foot of the Teton Mountain Range. It's about 30 miles long and it varies from 5 to 15 or so miles wide. It sits more than 6,000 feet above sea level. It has plenty of water in the Teton River and its tributaries, plenty of lush grass for grazing, and it was abundant with wildlife, including that valuable beaver. The famous mountain man Jim Bridger pronounced it as the finest valley in the world. Well, this scenic refuge made the perfect place to hold the annual rendezvous. If you're new to our podcast, a rendezvous is where all of the trappers and traders would come together to sell their furs, resupply themselves for the year, and reunite with friends who they hadn't seen for many months. The trading part usually lasted a day or two, and the next two or three weeks was kind of like the mountain man's annual vacation. In 1832, one of the largest rendezvous ever held in the Rocky Mountains took place here. In fact, more than 7 square miles of the valley hosted the rendezvous, and the camps stretched out were the temporary homes of more than 400 white men, nearly 700 natives, and almost 3,000 horses. Fur trapper Joe Meek gives us this description. All the parties were now safely in. The lovely mountain valley was populous with the different camps. The Rocky Mountain and American companies had their separate camps. Wyeth had his. A company of free trappers, 15, led by a man named Sinclair from Arkansas, had the fourth. The Nez Perce and Flatheads, the allies of the Rocky Mountain Company and the Friends of the Whites, had their lodges all along the streams, so that altogether there could not have been less than 1,000 souls and 2,000 to 3,000 horses and mules gathered in the place. The quote ends. Besides William Sublett and his Rocky Mountain Fur Company crew of almost 200, other small companies and famous individuals were in attendance. The son of Sacagawea, Jean-Baptiste Charbonneau, had joined the festivities. Many famous trappers were there, including Lucien Fontenelle, Henry Frabe, Jim Bridger, Joe Meek, Milton Sublette, and a few fur traders who hadn't made their name yet, like Nathaniel Jarvis Wyeth. In fact, Nathaniel was leading a party of New England greenhorns into the Oregon valleys to trade and explore. His group included two naturalists and two other guys who were the grandsons of Daniel Boone. Now, of those two naturalists, one was named John Kirk Townsend, and this man would go on to chronicle his trip through the Rocky Mountains, and that chronicle would change people's understanding of the natural world. Veteran fur trapper Thomas Fitzpatrick had been expected to show, but after several weeks of not appearing, he had been written off for dead. It turns out Thomas had run into trouble with a war party of Blackfeet, and in the end, he did show up, more dead than alive, just before the end of the event. Thomas has a dedicated episode if you want to hear more details of that story. It's unbelievable. Fur trapper Antoine Godin is a man half Iroquois and half white, and he's the guy who saved Fitzpatrick's bacon when the man collapsed half dead within sight of the rendezvous. Some of the men were from smaller fur companies, like Zenas Leonard was of the Gant and Blackwell Company. And even a few of Hudson Bay Company's trappers had snuck away from their company to come to the party. Some of the other rock stars of the rendezvous included Reverend Samuel Parker and renowned explorer Captain Benjamin Bonneville. In fact, one of the greatest recordings of this event comes from Bonneville, as he was a prolific storyteller. He recounted his life story to an author named Washington Irving, which gives us the following description of the rendezvous. In this valley was congregated the motley populace connected with the fur trade. Here, the two rival companies had had their encampments with their retainers of all kinds, traders, trappers, hunters, and half-breeds, assembled from all quarters, awaiting their yearly supplies and their orders to start off in new directions. The quote ends. After several weeks of trading, gambling, and drinking, the rendezvous was starting to wind down, and the trappers broke into their separate groups and companies and prepared to head back into the wilderness. On July 17th, Henry Frabe and Milton Sublette led their group of 100 or so trappers away from the encampment. Nathaniel Wyeth led his group of greenhorns out at the same time, traveling with Sublette's group for safety, because nothing says armed escort like 100 wilderness-hardened men carrying rifles. The two parties traveled south about 8 miles, and then they set up a combined camp for the night. Well, the following morning, a large group of natives on horseback, 150 to 200 men, women, and children, approached at top speed. At first, there was some hesitation on the trappers' part because they weren't sure what they were dealing with. So much dust was being kicked up, it was actually suggested that it was just a herd of stampeding buffalo. Eventually, with the help of Nathaniel Wyeth's cool new gadget that he just bought at the rendezvous called a spyglass, it was determined that the natives were of the Gros Ventre Nation, though many of the mountain men still held the belief that they were the much-feared and very hated Blackfeet. Zenas Leonard stated that the group sported a British flag, taken from the Hudson Bay Company trappers recently attacked by the Blackfeet Indians. But online, you'll also find a tale that the natives sported a white flag of truce, though none of the mountain men themselves say this. Not liking the looks of this situation, Milton Sublette sent a runner back to the rendezvous site to get support. The natives halted, and a chief named Baiho, by most accounts, stepped forward in greeting. And this is where, historically, we have a dilemma. Five of the participating mountain men chronicled the events. Warren Ferris, George Nadever, Zenas Leonard, Joe Meek, and Nathaniel Wyeth. And each gave five different stories. That's not uncommon. Even today, if you ask five different witnesses of a crime what they saw, they're going to give five different versions of the same story, basically. Unfortunately, the five accounts from the mountain men are so different, it's kind of hard to believe they're talking about the same event. It should be pointed out that of all of these mountain man journals, with the exception of Warren Ferris, were written many years after the man left the wilderness. And we all know how rendezvous stories take on a life of their own over the years. Generally, most accounts agree that Antoine Godin and a Flathead Indian, sometimes referred to as Baptiste Dorian, rode forward to greet the chief. Other accounts say that Antoine's companion was a Salish chief who had been wronged by the Blackfeet. And if you remember from a few minutes ago, Antoine Godin is half Iroquois and half white. His Iroquois father had been murdered a few years back by a Blackfoot war party, and Antoine still very much carried that grudge. Keep in mind, the majority of these natives were Gros Ventre, not Blackfeet. But that didn't seem to make a difference to Antoine and Dorian. So the two men who approached these natives are both men with a whole lot of hatred in their hearts and scores to settle. It's said, by most accounts, that Antoine extended his hand to the chief, and as the man reached out, Godin screamed for Dorian to shoot. Dorian unloaded his rifle into the chief's chest as Godin grabbed the chief's crimson blanket and jerked it from the falling corpse. Some versions say that the two white men then retreated to the trapper's camp, screaming their success, before the murdered chief even hit the ground, while others say that Antoine added insult to injury by scalping the man. However, the mountain men make no mention of a scalping. Either way, it's at this point that all hell breaks loose. The two parties each fell back and began constructing fortresses to shelter behind. The Grovents took shelter in a swampy thicket with willow and cottonwood trees. The women and children began gathering fallen branches and root snarls and throwing them into a crude wall around the warriors as they lay down covering fire. Milton Sublette and his crew returned fire, while Nathaniel Wyeth and his New England greenhorns tried desperately to shore up a fortress of firewood. The trappers were grossly outnumbered, and I'm sure they breathed a huge sigh of relief when William Sublette and a strong force of mountain men and native allies arrived from the rendezvous site. Mountain man Zenas Leonard was in that reinforcement party arriving from the encampment, and he gives us a first-hand account. We advanced with all possible speed and a full determination of success until we discovered their fort by receiving a most destructive fire from the enclosure. This throwed our ranks into complete confusion, and we all retreated into the plain. It was a loss of 5 whites, 8 flatheads, and 10 Nez Perce Indians killed, besides a large number of whites and Indians wounded. The formation of their fort astonished all hands. It was large enough to contain 500 warriors and built strong enough to resist almost any attempt we might make to force it. The quote ends. Upon his arrival, William Sublette instantly took over and began to organize the mountain men. Nathaniel Wyeth was getting underfoot, so Sublette relegated him to staying in the back and out of the way, letting the veteran marksmen take over. The result was a harrowing barrage of rifle shot pinging off the trees and walls that protected the Grovent. In one incredible instance, William Sublette is said to have drawn a bead on a hole in the brush wall, and the next eyeball that appeared to look out that hole, Sublette put a bullet in it with deadly accuracy. Taking considerable losses, the Indians hunkered down, and Sublette decided he needed a better plan to dislodge them. He suggested storming their little makeshift fortress. But his men thought it was too dangerous. After what is noted as a particularly rousing speech, 20 to 30 men and their native allies volunteered to crawl into the fray. William Sublette and a trapper named Robert Doc Campbell each led a small group, crawling on their hands and knees through the thick undergrowth to come out to this open space between the two warring parties. In that open space, they were terribly exposed, and Alexander Sinclair, that independent trader from Arkansas, was killed instantly. While William Sublette's crews drew their fire, his little brother Milton and several others made a circuitous route to get up behind the Grovent. The Flathead and the Nez Perce allies closed on the flanks of the Grovent fortress. But little progress was made, and by the end of it, William Sublette had a bullet in his shoulder, Milton had one in the leg, 10 others were injured, and 13 of the white men and their allies lay dead. The Grovent suffered as well. 10 of their warriors were dead, including one with a bullet in the eye, and so many were wounded. With no gains being made, William Sublette recalled his forces. And after a short rest, the mountain men stood up and took aim again. Sublette came up with the idea to burn them out, so anyone not sporting a rifle was set to work to gather combustible materials. But the Nez Perce allies protested. They didn't want to burn out the enemy while there was any chance that decent loot could be had. So the idea was scrapped, and the two sides continued to take shots at each other for the remaining afternoon. As dusk fell, one of the Grovent shouted out to the white men that 400 Blackfeet were coming to avenge them. One of the Nez Perce was brought over to interpret. After several shouted exchanges back and forth, the interpreter told Sublette that the Grovent had a force of 400 Blackfeet coming to attack the rendezvous site. Not waiting for confirmation of the threat, Sublette ordered everyone to retreat to the encampment. When they arrived at the rendezvous site and no attack was forthcoming, he realized his mistake. But it was too late. When the mountain men returned to the site of the battle the next morning, the only remaining Grovent were the dead ones. The embattlements were abandoned save for their luggage and 30 or so horses roaming freely about the site, including some that had been previously stolen from the Rocky Mountain Fur Company. Joe Meek recalled that On making this discovery, there was much chagrin among the white trappers and much lamentation among the Indian allies, who had abandoned the burning of the fort expressly to save for themselves the fine blankets and other goods of their hereditary foes. And according to Nathaniel Wyeth, the din of arms was now changed to the vulture and the howling of masterless dogs. Later, the Gros Ventre claimed 26 of their people had died, including some of the women and children. Not only was this the largest battle between the mountain men and the indigenous populations, but it set the tone for years to come. Nathaniel Wyeth's party of scholars had had enough and decided to return east. Wyeth had planned to accompany William Sublette's large group headed back to St. Louis with the fur train, but it was a full 10 days before Sublette would be well enough to ride. Now, if you recall, William's brother Milton Sublette had also taken a bullet, and now his leg was grossly infected. Both of the Sublette brothers required medical treatment that could only be found in St. Louis, and neither were in any condition to ride. Not wanting to wait any longer, Nathaniel Wyeth's group set out immediately, and the following day they were set upon by a Blackfoot war party. Two men were killed instantly and another wounded. Wyeth limped the survivors back to the rendezvous site over the course of a week, and he made it just in time to meet up with the Sublette mule train. Robert Campbell tended to the wounds of Wyeth's injured man as best as he could in the wilderness, and on July 30th, 1832, the whole party headed for home. The wounded man died shortly after they left. For many weeks, the Blackfeet and the Gros Ventre hovered around the vicinity of the traveling party, but none seemed brave enough to take on William Sublette and his deadly shot. Separately, Captain Bonneville and Lucien Fontenelle also reported the natives lurking in the shadows just out of rifle range, though neither man was attacked. The party arrived in St. Louis on October 3, 1832. William's shoulder had been broken when he took the bullet, and it took months to heal. Milton's leg had suffered a shot years earlier, and with this new injury, infection would become a constant problem. After three more years of struggling with it, a St. Louis doctor amputated it in 1835, but the remaining stump never healed correctly, and 2 years later, Milton died from it at the age of 36. Later accounts of the Battle of Pierre's Hole are credited to Captain Bonneville, although he didn't actually take part in the battle. He had left, and he headed in the opposite direction, and only later encountered William Sublette and Robert Campbell on their way back to St. Louis. Sublette and Campbell relayed the story, and Captain Bonneville included it in his records, though some of it does come across as very biased and embellished. For example, he records conversations held between Antoine Godin and his partner in crime just before they killed the chief, although no one else makes any mention of it. And while his account should probably be taken with a grain of salt, there are a few interesting tidbits if you keep in mind he wasn't there, and he is retelling third hand someone else's story. Now, one of those stories tells of the Nez Perce allies having a chief who they believed was bulletproof. In the course of the fight, the old man had been hit in the stomach by a spent ball, and he threw up blood. But the skin was unbroken, so his people were now fully convinced he was invulnerable to gunfire, which probably isn't going to end well in the next battle. Another story recounts the morning after the battle when the mountain men returned to find the abandoned camp. Washington Irving writes, "As some of the trappers and their Indian allies were approaching the fort through the woods, they beheld an Indian woman of noble form and features leaning against a tree. Their surprise at her lingering here alone to fall into the hands of her enemies was dispelled when they saw the corpse of a warrior at her feet. Either she was so lost in grief as not to perceive their approach, or a proud spirit kept her silent and motionless." He goes on to say, "Before the trappers could interfere, her mangled body fell upon the corpse which she had refused to abandon." And the quote ends. On an unrelated note, one of the most interesting things that arises out of this rendezvous is what was recorded by that naturalist, John Kirk Townsend. While it's no surprise that a mountain man's story would be embellished for the amusement of the listener, scientists tend to record just the facts, with very little embellishment or even emotion. They tend to be very detail-oriented and very articulate, including notes on behavior, habitat, and variations within a species. In 1839, John Kirk Townsend published his journal entries in a book entitled A Narrative of a Journey Across the Rocky Mountains to the Columbia River. His journals were an incredible contribution to our understanding of the distribution of wildlife species, and the abundance that existed before American settlement changed the face of the West forever. It's how we know how many beaver were there before the fur trade, during its heyday, and how few were left at the end. While Townsend took meticulous notes, he also collected specimens, including many skins from different species of birds found in the Rocky Mountains. These he would sell to an ornithologist back in Philadelphia, a guy by the name of John James Audubon, who compiled them with his own research and published an illustrated Birds of America book in 1838. To be fair, he had published a similar one in 1827, but with the addition of Townsend's specimens, the second version contained 435 life-size watercolor prints. It was the first of its kind. And what happened to Antoine Godin? Well, between September of 1834 and early 1836, he was in the employ of Nathaniel Wyeth as a hunter for Fort Hall in what is today Idaho. On May 22, 1836, he was out hunting on the Snake River when a band of Blackfeet appeared on the opposite side. The leader of their band was a Métis man named James Bird. Bird invited Antoine over to trade, and as Godin sat down to smoke and trade, one of the Blackfeet shot him in the back. Before Godin died, it's said that Bird tore off his scalp and carved the letters NJW into Antoine's forehead. Perhaps it was a message from Nathaniel Wyeth. We'll never know. That's it for this episode of the Furs and Frontiers podcast. Join me again in a few weeks for another trip through the history of the North American fur trade. And please check out the website at fursandfrontiers.com for an ever-growing list of resources and episodes, including the whole story of Thomas Fitzpatrick. You will not be disappointed. Have a great weekend, everybody, and keep your powder dry.